From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, one of the best comedic actors on television, David Hyde Pierce of Frasier. He just won his third Emmy for his role as Frasier's younger brother, Niles. David Hyde Pierce co-hosted the Emmy Award show last Sunday. Also, we hear from another Emmy Award winner, comic Chris Rock. His HBO show just won an Emmy for writing. It begins a new season tonight. Rock hosted the MTV Video Awards earlier this month. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Tiz, Frank McCourt's sequel to Angela's Ashes. And film critic John Powers reviews American Beauty, starring Kevin Spacey. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. North Carolina emergency officials launched a massive air and water rescue mission today. Dozens of residents in eastern North Carolina have been rescued from floodwaters brought on by Hurricane Floyd, but hundreds more are still stranded. And North Carolina Public Radio's Tim Crowley reports from Raleigh.
Some North Carolina residents are stuck on rooftops and trees after Hurricane Floyd dumped 15 inches of rain in the eastern half of the state. Emergency officials have deployed hundreds of boats, dozens of helicopters, and several swift water rescue teams to help. North Carolina Governor Jim Hunt says they're trying to help those stranded before floodwaters get worse.
We have a disaster like never before in North Carolina. Our mission today is to rescue people and prevent people from getting hurt or killed.
Crews are attempting to evacuate other portions of North Carolina that could see rising floodwaters tonight and tomorrow. They are also flying in food and water for 500,000 people that have no power for a third day. For NPR News, I'm Tim Crowley in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Tropical storm Floyd brought raging floodwaters to New Jersey. High water left people stranded on their rooftops in Bound Brook, New Jersey. The Raritan River rose to 13 feet above flood stage this morning. Police said they rescued at least 800 people by early afternoon. Governor Christy Whitman says officials won't be able to fully assess the damage until the floodwaters recede, but she said it may be months before some areas recover. UN Human Rights Commissioner Mary Robinson says she'll investigate alleged atrocities in East Timor and work to bring those responsible to justice. Robinson has just issued a report on her visit to East Timor last week. Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Robinson accuses pro-Indonesian militias and members of the Indonesian security forces of systematic killings, displacement, destruction of property, and intimidation. In her report, she blames the militias for carrying out mass killings in the East Timorese capital, Dili, and at a church in Suwai. She says women have been raped in both East and West Timor. Robinson estimates up to 200,000 civilians have been forcibly uprooted from their homes, and many are without food and water. She notes thousands of people are missing and says militias in West Timor have been hunting down students, intellectuals, and activists in refugee camps and taking them away. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
Indonesia began withdrawing its troops from East Timor today, loading equipment and weapons onto Navy ships prior to the arrival of a multinational peacekeeping force led by Australia. Indonesian commanders said it would take about a week to complete the withdrawal. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 66 points to close at 10,804 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Union flight attendants have overwhelmingly rejected a proposed new contract with American Airlines. The union paralyzed the carrier 6 years ago when a contract dispute led to a strike. Bill Zeeble reports from member station KERA in Dallas.
Of the union's 20,000 members, 73% of those who cast ballots decided to ground this contract in part because it eliminates profit sharing. APFA President Denise Hedges says the additional wages and benefits negotiated to replace the profit plan offered better pay over time. But many flight attendants felt profit sharing should not even be on the table. Hedges says it's clear her members want more. Because at least one proposal between the union and the airline has emerged so far, odds favor a good outcome the next time. The goal is to avoid a strike. In the fall of 1993, the APFA walked off the job for the first time in its history. It took federal intervention to smooth out the dispute. For NPR News, I'm Bill Ziebel in Dallas.
A federal judge in Kansas City, Missouri, has temporarily blocked the state from enforcing its new law against a controversial type of late-term abortion. Enforcement will be delayed for at least 10 days until a trial date is set for a lawsuit filed by Planned Parenthood. The law was to have taken effect last night after the state Senate voted to override a veto by Governor Mel Carnahan, a Democrat. The law would impose criminal penalties on anyone who performs the procedure known to its critics as a partial birth abortion. Planned Parenthood sued to have the new law declared unconstitutional, saying it's so vague it could subject almost anyone who performs an abortion to charges equivalent to murder. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David Hyde Pierce not only co-hosted the Emmys last Sunday night, he won his third Emmy for his portrayal of Niles, the younger brother on the sitcom Frasier. On this archive edition, we have an interview with David Hyde Pierce recorded last November. Both Frasier and Niles are psychiatrists. Frasier, played by Kelsey Grammer, hosts a call-in radio show. Niles' psychological insights didn't save him from one of the worst marriages and longest divorces in history. The brothers are snobbish, effete, egotistical, and insecure. Although they have a close relationship, they're very competitive and suspicious of each other. Here's Niles calling on Frasier.
Hello, I know I'm a bit early. I was hoping we might get a bite to eat before the theater.
Actually, Niles.
It'll be on me, of course, as a thank you for getting those replacement tickets.
It's about the tickets.
I know. I owe you money and my gratitude. And if I keep talking, you won't be able to tell me that you weren't able to get the tickets.
Just haven't been able to get them yet.
Oh, I knew you wouldn't get them.
Niles, please.
Oh, and now it's too late. It's 6 o'clock.
Please just calm down. I've made a few well-placed calls. I haven't heard back from a couple of people. Someone will call.
Well, someone better call, because everyone who's anyone is seeing this play. And you know who you are if you're not anyone? You're no one. And I've been someone much too long to start being no one now.
The character of Frasier originated on the show Cheers. I asked David Hyde Pierce if when he was cast in the show Frasier, he studied episodes of Cheers to get a sense of the family traits and mannerisms.
Yes, in fact, that's specifically what I did. I watched a lot of old episodes of Cheers to get the physical behavior, because I felt like when I looked at my own family, first of all, I look more like Kelsey than I look like any other member of my real family. So physical resemblance isn't necessarily the key, but what does happen is people have the same kind of speech patterns and the same physical mannerisms. We've all had the experience of looking in the mirror and being horrified to realize we were acting exactly like our mom or our dad. And that kind of stuff, I thought, was what would let people know that we were really brothers. If we moved in the same way, if we had the same tilt of the head when we spoke, if we hit words and voiced words in a similar way.
I know Kelsey Grammer's a big admirer of Jack Benny, and you can kind of see that in some of his gestures. Did you go back to Jack Benny also to kind of better get to what Kelsey Grammer would be like and register that family trait?
I didn't. That's something else that Kelsey does, which was a whole new kind of acting for me, which is, I don't know if you know the term sampling, which they can do with pieces of sound technology. You can sample the playing of an instrument with a synthesizer. And Kelsey can almost sample famous actors, like someone who does impressions, except what he does is he will incorporate Jack Benny or Betty Davis or James Mason or whoever into the line that he's saying as Frasier, so that it is simultaneously echoes the famous person, but it's really still Frasier speaking. And that gives him this enormous range. I even did a scene where he did Daffy Duck in a perfectly believable way.
Frasier, in a way, the show is a contrast in two types of masculinity. You know, the father who's the retired cop and loves sports and his old easy chair and meat and potatoes. And Frasier and Niles, who, are impeccably dressed and they're connoisseurs of wine and food and furniture. And in a way, they're almost like, they almost embody certain of the traits that are stereotyped as gay traits. Including some of their gestures. And I'm wondering if that's something that's ever discussed on the set or the show.
We don't ever discuss it on the show, although we did address it, actually, in an early episode. There's kind of a famous episode from the first season called The Matchmaker, where a new station manager took over Frasier's radio station, and the guy was gay, but Frasier didn't know it. And Frasier
tried.
That's
a very funny episode. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, yeah. Well, it was a great episode. Joe Keenan wrote it, one of our very good writers, and there was a whole mix-up where Frasier thought he was setting up this guy to date Daphne, and the guy thought it was a setup for him to date Frasier. And near the end of it, because of a variety of confusing circumstances, this guy also thinks that Frasier's dad is gay. And finally, it all gets straightened out at the end. And he says, so your dad's not gay? And he says, no, dad's not gay. And then the guy says, but Niles, come on. And it was our way of addressing, because a lot of people have talked about the fact, especially with Frasier and Niles and a lot of stuff that they do together, that, as you said, it's a sort of a stereotypical gay relationship, and that they like to dress well, they like fine wine and opera and all that stuff. But there's one critical part of gay relationships which they're not really into, and that seems to me to be the dividing line, and that's more of the anatomical area, which is they both love women. And so I think that the rest of it, as you said, it really is a stereotype if it necessitates them being gay because they like those things. There's a certain sort of, as you describe different kinds of masculinity, there's a very English, as opposed to English peasant, but a kind of an upper-class English feeling about them. Also a sort of Southern gentleman feeling, that it's a more of I guess you could say, a feline masculinity, as opposed to dad or bulldog, who's the sportscaster on the show, who's more of a, you know, eating hot dogs and beans and slapping people around kind of guy.
Right. Now, the writing is so funny on the show. Can you think of an example of lines that you particularly liked that kind of exemplify to you the quality of the writing?
Yes. The one that always pops into my head is there was a scene where the unseen Maris were having a party at Frasier's apartment, and no one can find her, and I explained that she fell asleep, and she's under all the coats on the bed. And my line is that she exhausts easily under the pressure to be interesting. And what I love about that line is, if you look at the actual wording of it, it's a little bit wordy, it's a little bit highfalutin. She exhausts easily under the. But what makes it funny is the description of this personality, because in some way we've all been there. We've all been at parties and had to put on that face, and we know how you go home, and it's supposed to have been a party, and you're wiped out from the effort. And she just takes it to the nth degree. So it's a combination of a skillful use of language, but also a skillful just depiction of character. And I think most of the humor of the show, as it should, comes out of situations like that, as opposed to jokes.
Because there's a kind of almost ornate style of speaking that Niles has. I'm sure his cadences are a little bit different than yours. Was it hard to get into that rhythm?
It's a good question. It wasn't difficult because it's well written. It's easy to pick up on the speech pattern. And again, because I was sort of modeling it after the way Kels speaks as Frasier, mm-hmm. I had a role model there. One of the things that we are always playing with, and one of the differences between the writers who write for our show and sometimes when people send in scripts that they've written in hoping to get hired for the show, is that the writers understand that there's a subtle difference between someone who uses language in a certain way and just simply writing a lot of big words because that somehow seems to be what the characters are all about. A lot of times we'll find that you have to tone Niles' language down because in a given situation, a very emotional situation, say, or for example, he might not fall into those elevated speech patterns that he would have when he's more relaxed and he's talking about the wine club. And I think that's also what keeps him real.
Would you compare your voice and style of speaking with Niles?
Well, it's hard. You know why? Because as soon as I start getting analytical and talking about the show and being philosophical about it, then I automatically almost become him. Let's see. There's a certain other placement in the voice that he speaks mm-hmm. almost in a little higher pitch than I do. And the pronunciation of the words is just a little bit archer and a little bit more enunciated and, what's the word? That sort of thing. And there's little inflections like that that creep in. Sometimes I'll be like somewhere else in the country and people will say, oh, you don't have an English accent. Thinking that I do have an English accent because of whatever it is I'm doing as the character, it's sort of, it reads that way.
Yeah, it's arch and clipped.
Yeah. And a little bit operatic at times. He gets extremely agitated over not very important things. We just had he was just invited to a party where he brought a bottle of 81 Chateau Haute-Brion, and he wasn't there 2 minutes before he heard a pop, looked up, and saw it being decanted into a punch bowl of sangria, canned fruit, and erotic ice cubes. So it is. It's sort of a higher range, I think, when he gets excited about
it. It must be interesting to play a character for so long that you have two, you know, different styles of speech that you know so well, your own and your character's.
Well, and in fact, I think I've played him so long that when you asked me the question about what was the difference between my speech and Niles, I got extremely nervous because I suddenly thought, you know, I'm not sure there is one anymore. I think that the gap has narrowed over the last 6 years.
Now, I know you shoot in front of a live audience, which means that there's real laughter that you have to deal with, which will affect the timing. You can't talk over the high point of a laugh. The trick is, I think, if the audience is laughing, and it's a fairly extended laugh, the camera doesn't pan to the audience. It's still on you. So you have to be doing something while you're not speaking during the laughter.
Yes. Well, we've all become masters of sort of idle fiddling and, you know, stirring coffee during long laughs, or you can check your shoelaces and see if they're tied. What it is, it's just fun. It's you try to find behavior that the character would actually be doing in the moment, but what you're also doing is you're feeding the laughter because it just makes people laugh more when they see you riding that wave of laughter, however you choose to ride it out. If Kels and I are in the scene together, then we can do a good 10 minutes of just making faces at each other until eventually we both laugh and then it's over.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Hyde Pierce, and he's the star of Frasier. He plays Niles, Frasier's brother. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Hyde Pierce, and he plays Niles on the series Frasier. Now, the story goes that, you know, no one knew that Frasier had a brother when Frasier was a character on Cheers. I don't think Frasier knew he had a brother. And then when he was given the new series, he still wasn't supposed to have a brother, but the story goes that the creators of the show were given a picture of you, saw this incredible facial similarity, then watched tapes of you, loved your performance, and thought, well, let's write him in as the brother. Did you see the similarity when you looked at Kelsey Grammer?
My mom, when I first came out to L.A., which is about 6 or 7 years ago, said to me, now, you look like Kelsey Grammer. Maybe you could be on his show. And that was back on Cheers.
And, really?
Yeah, and no one else thought that at the time. But then, totally without me having anything to do with it, this casting director, Sheila Guthrie, who was working with Jeff Greenberg, the main casting director for Frasier, she brought them my photo. And they didn't know who I was, like most people. And like you said, she also brought them some tapes from the only other TV show I'd ever done, only other sitcom, which was called The Powers That Be. And it was a Norman Lear political satire where John Forsythe played a senator. I played a suicidal congressman. And they looked at those tapes, and based on those, they actually met with me. And this is the humiliating part, because they met with me for about half an hour, and then they went away and wrote Niles. So I don't know what that says about me, but it's that's the way it fell out.
Right. So it's funny because although I see certain similarities between you and Kelsey Grammer, you're a much more kind of refined version of that. You know, smaller and, you know, more elegant.
Refined is nice. I like refined. You know what? If you see pictures of him, I saw a shot of him. He was just out of college. It was taken in New York. He was on a soap opera back then when he was still going to Juilliard. And he looks, it's me. It isn't even he looks like me. It's me. Mm-hmm. And so I think we, depending on the year of the show, we look more or less alike each other. But there's definitely a familial resemblance kind of thing.
David Hyde Pierce is my guest, and he plays Niles on Frasier. I'd like to run through some of the movies that you've been in, and maybe you could just say a few words about your part in each one and what it was like for you. Let's start with your movie premiere debut, Bright Lights, Big City.
Yes, that was my first ever. It cost me more to join the union than they paid me to do the film. In fact, my agent had to advance me the money so I could do this movie. And I had one line. It was with Michael J. Fox was in this movie. If you ever see it, there's a scene where he goes to disrupt a fashion show that Phoebe Cates is doing. And I'm standing behind a bar, and I say, "I'm sorry, the bar is closed." And that was my first memorable line.
Did you practice saying that 1,000 different ways before doing it for real?
Well, for one thing, I was a nervous wreck. I mean, I had been a stage actor for many years. I'd been on Broadway and off-Broadway and gone all over the place. I'd never done a movie, and they don't know that, and they treat you as if you're an old pro, and they say, okay, now this is what's going to happen. He's going to come up, the camera's going to be here, you're going to hit your mark, you're going to do that, and you, of course you say, yeah, right, I'll be there. And you're thinking, what's a mark? What am I hitting? Who do I hit? Do I hit? Who's Mark? And it was very disturbing, but I got through that, and no one was injured, so I think I did okay.
Okay, Crossing Delancey.
Oh.
Let me guess, you were the non-Jewish character.
I did once audition for a play in New York they did called Ashana Madel, and it was for a Jewish character, and I had to say the line, "You only love me for my mother's bagels." And I didn't believe me saying it, and so... They were very nice during the audition. No one asked me to leave or anything. But anyway, no, I was a non-Jewish character in Crossing Delancey. I love that movie, by the way. It's a sweet film. And what I most remember about it was I had to learn to play the cello. My character was a cellist, and there was a scene where Amy Irving, who's the lead in the movie, was having a birthday, and all of us who worked in this little bookstore with her were singing Happy Birthday to her, and I was playing it on the cello. And I literally, they paid for lessons. I learned how to play Happy Birthday on the cello. Amy Irving, who had done a movie called The Competition where she had to pretend to play the cello, made endless fun of me because, you know, I was squeaking. But I finally got through the take and did it, and it was all perfect. And that scene segued into a scene on a phone from Florida where her parents' friends, who are a barbershop quartet, are finishing singing Happy Birthday over the phone. Well, when they put the film together, the guys singing the barbershop quartet were in a different key, so they dubbed the cello playing. So what I had slaved for weeks to learn, I'd never had to do in the first place. They were just going to lay it in anyway. So,
Tough luck.
It was hard.
Oh. Sleepless in Seattle.
That was my first connection with Seattle. And that, you know, of course, was a big hit movie. I had a very small part in it, but the funny thing is if you go back and watch it, the little scenes that I have, I play Meg Ryan's brother. I'm actually married. I'm in a very similar marriage to the one that Niles has with Maris. The actress who plays my wife is a little on the petite side, and she's kind of shrewish the way the character's written, and we have sort of a hate relationship, I think. But it was sort of foreshadowing of the rest of my life.
In Oliver Stone's movie Nixon, you played John Dean. Mm. What did you do to get in character?
Met with John Dean. Had several meetings with him did a lot of reading about John and the whole Watergate crisis and found out that depending on which book you read, John Dean was either a completely innocent victim of this whole thing or the evil mastermind behind the entire Watergate scenario, which was a little bit of a history lesson. And the other thing I did was watch the tapes of the hearings. And other than that, it was just the thrill of, you know, acting scenes with Anthony Hopkins.
What did you do with your voice for John Dean? It's such a familiar voice for people who remember the Watergate hearings.
Yeah, I didn't do a lot. There was a little bit of, I'm trying to think what it was. He's from California, and it wasn't that he had a particular accent. I think maybe some of the vowels were a little flatter than mine. Again, I didn't. None of us were trying to do exact imitations of the people. I mean, Anthony Hopkins is the most obvious example that when he did Nixon, he's completely capable of doing a spot-on Rich Little quality Nixon impression. But he didn't want people to watch him do a Nixon impression because the most you get out of that is sitting there thinking, oh, he's really good doing a Nixon impression. So he kind of split the difference between hinting at Nixon's actual voice and certainly getting the physical mannerisms, but really making it more of a character performance for him. And to my taste, I think that was a really smart choice.
So I want to hear about other movies and stuff that you have coming up outside of Frasier.
Over the past hiatus, I was in Montreal shooting a movie which is a biography of Jacqueline Suzanne that stars Bette Midler as Jackie and Nathan Lane as her husband and manager, Irving Mansfield. And John Cleese is in it, Stockard Channing, Amanda Peet. It's a great cast, and it's a terrific script by Paul Rudnick, who wrote In and Out and Jeffrey and the Addams Family movies and stuff like that.
David Hyde Pierce, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you. I really want to thank you.
Well, thanks, Terry.
David Hyde Pierce recorded last November. He just won his third Emmy for his portrayal of Niles on Frasier. The new season begins next Thursday on NBC. The Jacqueline Suzanne movie, Isn't She Great?, is due out early next year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, by the National Endowment for the Arts, and by Elektra Entertainment, whose latest releases include Nancy Griffith's new album, The Dust Bowl Symphony, a collection of new recordings of her songs performed with the London Symphony Orchestra. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Tonight, The Chris Rock Show begins a new season on HBO. Last week, it won an Emmy for its writing. Coming up, an interview with Chris Rock. Also, book critic Maureen Carrigan reviews Tiz, Frank McCourt's sequel to Angela's Ashes, and film critic John Powers reviews American Beauty. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The sequel to Frank McCourt's blockbuster memoir, Angela's Ashes, has just been published. It's called Tiz. A movie adaptation of Angela's Ashes is scheduled for release in December. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan wonders if we've had our fill of Frank McCourt.
We Irish Americans, together with our old country cousins, are an odd people, psychologically speaking. From generation to generation, we pass down sad songs and stories about Ireland's tragic history. Our ethnic mascot is the underdog. But when one of our own, like Frank McCourt, becomes a smashing success, instead of applauding, we collectively mutter, "Who does he think he is?" All the people I know who grew up in an Irish household heard that put down whenever they were thought to be getting too full of themselves. That's why that as the McCourt craze is cresting this month with the publication of Tiz, the sequel to the phenomenally, some would say inexplicably popular Angela's Ashes, the McCourt backlash is also gathering force among his own kind. "Out, out, damn McCourt," intoned an Irish friend of mine upon seeing McCourt's face on the cover of last Sunday's New York Times magazine. Looking at this new memoir's book jacket, another friend, Irish by marriage, grumbled, "Tiz, eh? Why doesn't he just put a big dollar sign on the cover?" And it must have been my own perverse Irish blood at work some months ago, when I'd only just heard of and not yet read Tiz, that made me scribble down the first sentence of my review, "Tisn't." But see, I couldn't use it. Much as my heritage makes me ache to cut down the mighty McCourt, I enjoyed the book a lot. Oh, sure, it's not as rich as Angela's Ashes, but that's almost inevitable. After all, the first memoir dealt with childhood, the magical, and in McCourt's case, often nostalgically nightmarish time of life. If I liked McCourt the man in Tiz less than I did the boy, it's because I held him more responsible for the awful fixes he finds himself in. The toilet problems and drink troubles that were a staple subject in Angela's Ashes surface here, too. But now I'm more impatient rather than sympathetic. What's still so attractive about McCourt, however, is his voice. Almost every paragraph here could be used to illustrate the dictionary definition of black humor. That's another behavioral quirk the Irish learn early. Always be sure to make fun of yourself and your situation before somebody else beats you to it. In Tiz, which is essentially an immigrant memoir, we learn about McCourt's escape from damp Limerick to dazzling post-war New York City. No sooner does he land in America than he also lands, against his timid will, in the bed of the predatory priest he met on the boat going over. As is obligatory in these kinds of stories, McCourt soon encounters all manner of New World eccentrics, the literary bartender who won't serve him a beer until he goes off to the public library and reads Dr. Johnson, the drunken landlady who invites him in for a Christmas meal of kibasi around the bedside of her son, who's a vegetable, the burnt-out principal of the vocational school where he gets his first teaching job, who advises him to just stay a few pages ahead of the kids, tell them this is 1958, tell them their names, tell them they live on Staten Island, and they'll be surprised and grateful for the information. This is not high IQ plateau. What elevates Frank McCourt out of the company of all those hail fellow, well-met type of Irishmen, like his raconteur brother Malachy, whose own recent autobiography bombed, is his somber respect for some horrors that can't be cauterized by laughter. In a classroom closet of that same vocational high school, McCourt finds piles of ungraded essay written by his current students' old neighbors and uncles, guys who were killed in World War II. His hard-boiled students read the essays and weep. When recalling his very first job in New York as a houseboy sweeping up after college kids at the Biltmore Hotel, McCourt dramatizes, brutally, the self-loathing that's bred deep into his working-class bones. That's maybe the greatest strength of Tiz, how McCourt captures the isolation of a working-class kid trying to better himself. When he finally makes it into college, courtesy of the GI Bill, he's patronized by his professors and alienated from his fellow students who revel in existential despair. Meanwhile, on the New York City docks, where he's supporting his studies by unloading frozen meat, his fellow workmen call him a fairy, drop crates into his arms, and, the last straw, smear pigeon droppings onto his ham sandwich. Most of them seem to be Irish. It's the old, who do you think you are, backlash again. Speaking of backlash, I think that one not-so-flattering reason why Angela's Ashes continues to be such an astounding bestseller is that it comes at a cultural moment when a lot of embattled white readers want to be affirmed in their feelings that, hey, my family had it rough too. Tiz will speak implicitly to those same feelings, and because it's also affecting and finely written, it'll probably be another mega-hit for McCourt. Damn his eyes.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Frank McCourt's new memoir, Tiz. Coming up, an interview with comic Chris Rock. This is Fresh Air. Chris Rock has spent a lot of time in the public eye recently. He hosted the MTV Video Awards. Last Sunday, he got to pick up his own award at the Emmys when his HBO variety series won for its writing. The Chris Rock Show's new season begins tonight. His latest HBO special ran earlier this summer. Rock is a fearless comic, whether he's tackling highly charged subjects like race and politics or just making fun of fellow celebrities. The first time he joined us on Fresh Air was in 1991, when he was a cast member on Saturday Night Live. One of the characters he did back then was a homeboy from the projects with his own talk show called I'm Chillin'.
Yo, 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 what's up? Welcome to I'm Chillin'. The showsy, showsy, showsy with the housey, housey, houseys. Now, I'm your host on ski to the highest degree, to the T-O-P. Yo, it's all about Mike. And sitting by my side is my main man, my ace in the hole, my New Jersey toe, my Esther Roll, my 10-foot pole, my Billy Joel, my Nat King Cole, my Dead Sea Scroll, my Dr. Show, my Helmet Cole, my Grassy Knoll, my Kid Creole, my La Caja Foe.
We're going to hear an excerpt from Chris Rock's second Fresh Air interview in 1997, just before the release of a CD adapted from an HBO special, which furthered Rock's reputation for controversial material.
Probably the most controversial part of this part of this, cutting right to the chase, is what you describe as the civil war between black people. In fact, let me play an excerpt of this sketch.
Oh, boy. Now, we got a lot of things, a lot of racism going on in the world right now. Who's more racist, black people or white people? Black people. You know why? Because we hate black people, too. Everything white people don't like about black people really don't like about black people. There's some shit going on with black people right now. It's like a civil war going on with black people. And there's two sides. It's black people and there's niggas. And niggas have got to go. Every time black people want to have a good time, ignorant ass niggas up. Can't do shit. Can't do nothing. Can't keep a disco open more than 3 weeks. Grand opening, grand closing. Can't go to a movie the first week it come out. Why? Because niggas are shooting at the screen.
What is the range of reaction, Chris Rock, that you've gotten to this sketch?
Wow, you know what's weird?
What?
It's been nothing but positive reaction. This whole special, the only negative reaction I've ever gotten from this special, and I'm not jumping on a bandwagon here trying to get, you know, famous, is Bill Cosby.
What did he say?
Well, he didn't say anything. He just wanted his... In the beginning of the special, I have a bunch of old comedy album covers flashing. And these are just guys I grew up with and I really loved. And it's Bill Cosby and it's Woody Allen and it's Flip Wilson and Dick Gregory and Pygmy Markham and Eddie and Pryor. And they're just like my heroes. And he wanted his album removed, so I guess he didn't like
the special. But other than that, it's been nothing but good reaction.
Were you thinking about particular experiences you had or particular people you know when you wrote this?
Boy, again, it's like the Hulk syndrome. It's like, I'm not really thinking about anything. I'm just interpreting. This is like, you know, everything I said in that routine, my mother said, my father said, I heard in barbershops. It's not like I'm, you know, it's not like I invented anything, you know.
Help me
this
out.
This has been, you know, these views have been out there forever. Just nobody said it.
You know, I couldn't help but wonder, listening to it, if a white comic said exactly the same thing you said, it would have a completely different meaning, I think.
Yes, it would. Why would a white comic want to say what I said? Why would that ever be, in what context would that ever be necessary?
So what's the difference between you saying it and a white comic saying it?
I can say it. What's the difference between someone calling your kid an idiot and you calling your kid an idiot? It's a big difference. It's a huge difference.
Your
kid knows what you mean when you say it. Your kid knows you just mean he's messing up. When somebody else says it, boy, that's mean.
Did you go through a radical black consciousness period when you were in your teens?
No, you know, I didn't go through I was in my teens. That's like the 80s. So it's not exactly the most conscious decade or time. You know, I was bused to school as a kid.
Mm-hmm. From where to where?
From Brooklyn, Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, to Garrison Beach, Brooklyn, and to Bensonhurst. And, you know, I was getting called nigger since I was, like, in the second grade. So I never, I was always in tune with my blackness, even, you know, from the time I was, you know, in the second grade.
Weren't there a lot of other people from your neighborhood who got bused to Bensonhurst?
There was like a contingent, about like five of us.
Five? That's all?
Yeah, it wasn't, you know, from my, you know, when I say the neighborhood, I'm just talking about like a block, like a two block radius. You know, when you grow up like in a bad neighborhood, there's not a lot of venturing out. So my neighborhood was like two blocks to me. Then the rest of the neighborhood, I didn't go anywhere because anything could happen. My mother wasn't having it.
So how many African-American students would you say there were in the schools that you got
in the schools? Okay. I was like the only black kid in my grade a couple of times.
Wow. Uh-huh.
I was the only black boy. And then there were like two black girls, three black girls. For like most of my grade school. And the girls had each other. I was kind of like by myself. And I would have, you know, it's weird. Even though I would get, you know, beat up and, you know, all that other stuff. Of course, my best friend would end up being white in that same environment. Then he'd get beat up for being my friend. It's a weird circle of events.
So you think that contributed to your being a comedian because you were so alienated?
Yeah, I was alienated, and I had nothing else to do. You know, I always loved comedy. You know, I had nothing to fall back on. I have no real skills. You know, if I picked up a paper right now and, you know, went through the want ads, there's nothing I could get that would pay me more than minimum wage. So I loved comedy, got into it, was a little twisted. You know, my schooling had twisted me somewhat. And it really helped me out. I mean, I would say probably today, a lot of black people, you don't really experience racism hands-on. You always, like my brothers who didn't get bused to school, like they experience the effects of racism, you know, living in a bad neighborhood, you know, you can't get the cab, you know, bad jobs, all that stuff. But very few people get that, especially in the North, that, hey, nigga, you know, that in your face every day. You know, there's not a lot of guys my age that have been through what I've been through.
Now, I have a question about your voice. Your voice in your onstage performances, in when you're doing comedy, is much deeper, louder, and rougher than your voice in conversation, which is higher and lighter.
Right.
Almost sweeter, if I could use that word.
Oh, thanks.
And I almost feel like, gee, are you not comfortable with that voice on stage? Do you feel like you need a harder-edged voice to do your comedy?
Well, you know, it's the money's on the line. It's like people are paying $25. They want a performance. They don't want me. They want me to be better than me. I got to look better than me. I got to be taller, louder, funny. I have to be more. So, I mean, when you're on stage, it's kind of like being a woman, you know? It's like, put on the makeup, do the hair. You know, nobody wants me. They want Chris Rock. I'm just Chris.
So you got to put on a personality on stage.
Well, I got to be bigger than I normally am. I mean, at the same token, I couldn't walk through life acting the way I act on stage.
Well, right, without getting hit a lot, probably.
Right, exactly.
What did being really skinny, do you think, affect who you became and how people thought of you? Or, you know, how you see yourself as a comic? Were you kind of scrawny as a kid?
I'm scrawny now as a man. Totally. Being skinny has affected every aspect of my life. Every decision I make, everything I put on. Put it this way. Look at my stand-up. My stand-up, I have twice as many... I always say comedy, stand-up comedy and boxing are pretty much the same. You know, boxing is to sports what stand-up is to entertainment. Because it's just a guy out there by himself. And I perform like a skinny boxer, where I don't have the ability to knock you out. So I have you take my hour special and anybody else's hour special. I probably have twice as many jokes compact in it. Because my size has me so insecure, I'm always working twice as hard. So, yeah, being skinny has totally affected me and totally weirded me out.
Speaking of boxing,
men are crazy.
Did people fight with you a lot when you were young and take advantage of your size?
Totally. And the only reason they don't do it now is because I'm me.
Right, you're famous.
That's the only reason.
Did you learn to fight?
When you're as small as I am, it doesn't really matter.
Try martial arts or anything?
Martial arts, some big guy will just grab you and throw you down. What's the point?
Did you try to cripple your opponent with comedy?
I've just, you know, stayed out of environments and situations where fights may occur. No drinking. Like, I don't drink because I can't fight. Wherever it is, alcohol served as a bouncer because people get out of hand. So I can't. Too little to be around guys that get out of hand. So I can't drink. Poor, woe is me. I'm sure Woody and Spike think the same.
Right, right. Well, that's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, you can have him on your show and talk about it. A little self-help.
Yeah. That's why I love Spike, Brooklyn and Skinny.
Chris Rock, recruited in 1997. The new season of The Chris Rock Show premieres tonight on HBO. Coming up, John Powers reviews the new movie American Beauty, starring Kevin Spacey. This is Fresh Air.
Our film critic John Powers has a review of American Beauty, starring Kevin Spacey. It's the first film by British theater director Sam Mendes.
At the beginning of Billy Wilder's Sunset Boulevard, we're greeted with the voice of a dead man who proceeds to tell the story of how he came to die. Something similar happens in American Beauty. But where Wilder's movie was about extraordinary things, pure Hollywood gothic, this hilariously wrenching portrait of a disgruntled family takes place in that bastion of normalcy, suburbia. Kevin Spacey stars as Lester Burnham, an ad man who feels he's lost something but doesn't know what it is. He can't stand his wife, Carolyn, played by Annette Bening, an uptight real estate agent who wants everything around her to be picture perfect. And he mourns his lost closeness to their teenage daughter, Jane, played by Thora Birch. She's become the romantic obsession of the boy next door, Ricky Fitz. That's Wes Bentley, a video-mad doper with the air of a handsome alien. In a desperate quest for rejuvenation, Lester starts ogling his daughter's tardy friend, Angela, played by Mina Suvari, who coyly leads him on. Soon he's pumping iron to get in shape for Angela, hoping she'll provide an escape from things like the snippy coldness of dinner with his wife and daughter.
Mom, do we always have to listen to this elevator music?
No, we don't. And as soon as you've prepared a nutritious yet savory meal that I'm about to eat, you can listen to whatever you like.
So, Janie, how was school?
It was okay.
Just okay?
No, Dad. It was spectacular.
Well, you want to know how things went at my job today? They've hired this efficiency expert, this really friendly guy named Brad. How perfect is that? And he's basically there to make it seem like they're justified in firing somebody because they couldn't just come right out and say that, could they? No, that would just be too honest. And so they've asked us, you couldn't possibly care less, could you?
Well, what do you expect? You can't all of a sudden be my best friend just because you had a bad day. I mean, hello. Barely even spoken to me for months.
Oh, what? Your mother of the year? You treat her like an employee.
American Beauty is the first screenplay by Alan Ball, who worked on the TV shows Sybil and Grace Under Fire. And its opening hour is filled with the nasty, Wilder-esque humor you'd expect from a sitcom writer who can finally uncork his malice and libido. At first, Ball's characters seem like cartoons, the Martha Stewart wannabe, the tract house Humbert Humbert, and so forth. But Ball's trick is to give them shading, to gradually transform them into flesh and blood. We feel the sadness pulsing beneath each of their habitual stances toward life, be it Lester's smart cracks, Carolyn's self-help mantras, or Ricky's zenned-out notion that there's an entire world behind the immediate surface of things. Though Ball fills his plot with wonderful twists, we don't really feel him stacking the deck until the powerful but slightly fishy climax, when the story's taken over by that obligatory American prop, a gun. It helps that American Beauty is wonderfully acted. We believe the gravely moving performances by Birch and Bentley, relative newcomers whose brooding intelligence as Jane and Ricky passes a harsh judgment on their run-amuck elders. If Bening is too broad, she's still very funny in a role that's only half misogynistic. And Spacey's work is brilliantly rich and kaleidoscopic, sniping at his wife, belting out a stoned chorus of American Woman, tiptoeing around young Angela like a love-struck teen. In the process, Lester goes from being the familiar Spacey figure, smirky and snide and a bit creepy-crawly, to a genuinely touching soul, a disillusioned man who rediscovers, perhaps too late, how to be a decent human being. The movie's a triumph for director Sam Mendes, best known here for bringing Cabaret and The Blue Room to Broadway. Mendes is a double outsider, both an Englishman and a newcomer to filmmaking, and his debut is astonishing for his ease with a new country and new medium. He neatly orchestrates the tricky shifts in tone, from stinging satire and chilling violence to breathless longing. As his camera glides over the treetops that line the Burnhams' neighborhood, Mendes makes us feel the many resonances of the film's title, not all of them ironic. At one point, Ricky shows Jane his favorite piece of video footage, a plastic bag caught in the wind, circling and leaping in a miraculous dance. It's an image of grace, a stolen moment in which the most prosaic of things provides a glimpse of the transcendent. You could say much of the same thing of this revelatory movie, which is suffused with absurdity, lost innocence, and a yearning for something more, a distinctively American kind of beauty.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Petopia.com, offering food, advice, toys, treats, and supplies delivered to pets and their people nationwide, on the web at Petopia.com. Additional support from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD, on the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Bantam Books, publishers of In Pursuit of the Proper Sinner, a modern British mystery by Elizabeth George, available in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a conversation with Jane Goodall about her work studying chimpanzees in the wild and the spirituality that sustained her. She has a new memoir called Reason for Hope, A Spiritual Journey. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.